Because when you say it out loud, right, we're going to make an animated feature film commercial in a video game engine. So I remember working on Colin McRae Rally for Codemasters back in the day.
What a game.
What a game.
Yes, I was hoping you were going to bring that up. One of my favorite
games
of all
time.
That
was for you, Luke. That was for you. So I was at the Game Developers Conference in March this year, and Tim Sweeney comes up and he's like Steve Jobs, like on everyone's like, woo! And then they showed UEFN. And there was three things that stood out for me and pretty much everyone in that room as well, which was, holy shit, we can bring our own content into Fortnite, like our own environments that doesn't need to look like Fortnite, we can do that.
This is a conversation with the awesome and very lovely Haz Dalul, who is a filmmaker, VFX and virtual production wizard. He now leads the team at his studio, Hazimation, where they develop and produce feature films, TV and video games using primarily Unreal Engine as their key tool in their pipeline. Now, along with the metaverse as a whole, there is also a huge shift in how content is being made across all these different disciplines and how it's all kind of colliding as well, Unreal Engine being a massive part of all of that. Haz is right at the forefront of it, so is the perfect person to explain the opportunities of the future. Now, we start the conversation mainly with a bit of background in filmmaking, and then the metaverse conversation begins at about 20 minutes in. It was a brilliant chat throughout, so thank you very much to Haz for coming on. All of his links are below, so do give him a follow and enjoy the episode.
Firstly, thanks for like getting me on the show. Like, you know, obviously I've been following Supermassive for a while as well on Twitter and all the cool work that you guys are doing. Yeah, I mean, I could go into deep dive, but I'll give kind of like an overview. I started my career in video games, like 98, kind of like PlayStation 2 days. Then went into film visual effects as a visual effects artist, working on movies like Hellboy, worked on previs for The Dark Knight. And that's essentially where my film school came from. Then became a VFX supervisor, VFX producer, nominated for a bunch of Visual Effects Society Awards, really flexing there. And is that someone's phone ringing?
It's someone at the door. Someone at the door. They found me.
They found you.
Yeah. We are on a live set. Yeah.
They want their seat back.
We haven't got a red light above the door, which is kind of how we should be doing this. We're probably a red light and bell. Let's go.
I love how raw this is. This is brilliant.
It's the way. It's the way. I'll turn. Yeah. I think someone's gone now.
All good. And then from visual effects, I decided to move into filmmaking, but I just made a bunch of short films because, you know, as if working in visual effects wasn't a crazy amount of hours spent in your day, I decided in whatever hours I had left, I'm just going to go make some short films. So one of them was the FUBAR, which is sort of like an animated 2.5D thing I did in Nuke. It's one of the first things done in Nuke using 2.5D.
You're going to have to explain to people what Nuke is, because I'll be like, what the hell is Nuke? Is that like Duke Nukem? Is that a video game? No, it's not a video game.
Right? No. And Nuke is a compositing software. Back in the day, we used to use things called Combustion and Shake and Flame. These are things basically takes live action CG, put it together to get the final image. So it's compositing, like Photoshop for videos. So Nuke was the biggest thing that came out at the time where you were able to bring a 3D camera in as opposed to just doing 2D. And it's like After Effects and Photoshop put together.
I still think we're going to have to reduce and simplify this. So compositing is the act of taking two things that don't belong together and making it look as if they do belong together, which is correct. Like when you're saying Photoshop. So like green screen, you take the green out, you put something else behind it. That's compositing. But like that is so like the simplest version of this. Compositing can be anything. It's basically collage
and creating a
new thing that wasn't there out of disparate elements. And it's super fun.
And removing things as well. Remember,
and removing things. Yes.
Yeah.
a lot of wire removal or changing logos on billboards or these kind of things. It was like the stock in trade, and it's funny because the suite of products that the Foundry made they're all like named after types of fire. I don't know why. It was like smoke and flame and tinderbox. I don't know. But
well, smoke and flame were Autodesk, right? So
yeah,
that's Autodesk. That was like the expensive. That was like the big boy commercials compositing. You know, like if you were a flame op, you get paid a shit ton of money, and you work with some of the biggest clients and agencies in Soho. Whereas now, like, you know, everyone's using like Nuke and After Effects to comp film level stuff.
And that was the time when DaVinci Resolve was it was a hardware solution that was like $250,000 pounds, and you would sit in a suite with your film there going through a machine called a spirit machine, and it would get fed into the Resolve is now free. It's a free piece of software.
I know.
It's like, what the hell? It's insane. Now the thing about Nuke that I think probably this is like to try and bring it home. Like After Effects is basically Photoshop. You put layers on top of other layers. Nuke is node-based, which means you can make much more complex recipes of things. And node-based is quite hard to get your head around, but like Nuke was node-based, and therefore it was just this insane tool. Yeah. What year was that?
Oh my God, this was like 2009, I think it was, around there.
Yeah.
I mean, there was like when Nuke came out, there was only a small number of people that were using it, because Nuke was originally something developed by Digital Domain, the big visual effects company that did all those big movies for like Michael Bay and James Cameron and so on. And it was an internal tool, and then that got sold to the Foundry, and then they made it more commercialized. And there was only like a handful of people using it. It was like myself and a bunch of like compositors using it. And that's how we got a lot of like, you know, I was able to go to places like IBC and talk about stuff. That's why I ended up making my short film as a way to push the 2.5D, which is like pseudo 3D in Nuke. And I kind of like built my composite and VFX supervising career that way. But being a VFX supervisor meant that I had to step away from the studio, like hands-on on box, and work mostly on set. So I got to work with some amazing directors, some like not so amazing directors, but you learn from them. But the good thing about being a VFX supervisor was it was essentially my film school, because you really learned how to work with a crew. You really had to understand set etiquette. And you quickly realized that VFX is the most important in the show, but also on the set, it isn't the most important. They're like, look, just do your chrome ball and your tracking and get out of the way, because we've got the rest of the day to do. So you're very closely working with the first AD. You're working with the director, working with the cinematographer and a production designers to try to usually solve this one thing, which is we have this huge ambition. We have this amount of money, a short amount of money, and we have this compressed schedule. How do we make that happen? And that's essentially the job of VFX supervisors, to figure that out with the filmmaker. But I got to learn so much about lenses and everything, and just really, I think, kind of made me the filmmaker I am today by being a VFX soup. But yeah, and going back to like making those short films, I made a bunch of them, and one of them kind of broke out. One of them was called Project Kronos, which was kind of like a fake documentary. And again, I did all on my laptop, on my MacBook. I think it's like one of the early MacBook Pros, Adobe After Effects, Premiere, and downloaded a shit ton of footage from the NASA website, because it's all public domain, right? Downloaded all of that, comped it all, you know, edited it together, replaced all the NASA logos with my own logo, comped my own spaceship, and recorded a bunch of like really talented actors who are now like my closest friends to become these scientists. And as we put it out there, it was just something I just wanted to put out there, because at the time I was VFX producing and supervising a show for BBC and Discovery, one called Planet Dinosaurs, another one called Beyond Earth. And I was in documentary mode, but very visual effects heavy ones. So I just did it. And I had no idea, but it actually blew out. Like, you got a Vimeo staff pick. And back then, a Vimeo staff pick is a big deal. I don't know how much of a big deal it is today, but like, back then, it's like massive deal. Every like website was covering it. Like, IO9 was covering it. Just everything was covering it. And all of a sudden, I'm getting calls from my agents and managers in LA. I'm like, I thought I had to like submit stuff to festivals to get this like recognition. And all of a sudden, I'm like, damn, the internet is powerful, man. Like,
yeah, we have to contextualize this, because we basically what happened was, we came out of the 1990s in this rich vein of films. Like, the film was successful in the 1990s. We then breached the millennium, and something strange started to happen, which was like reality TV just went nuts, because we had these cheap digital cameras. So we had the PD-150, that was the Sony camera of choice, and that meant you could basically shoot anything you wanted, give a camera to a production assistant and just get stuff shot. Reality TV blew up, and that put films in a really strange spot, because the kind of mid-level film that might have got made wasn't getting made anymore. And so studios were looking for spectacle, and obviously spectacle costs money. This coincided with the rise of just like this weird internet community. You had Blender, which is open source. Yeah. You had people like Andrew Kramer from Video Code Pilot, who was putting out tutorials about how to make cheap visual effects in your bedroom. You had Freddie Wong doing YouTube videos where he was doing crazy visual effects. You had Corridor Digital back in the early days when they were just kids. And then you had like probably 4 or 5 breakout visual effects whiz kids who went on to make feature films. And those were Wes Ball, who did The Maze Runner. He did this incredible short film that got him The Maze Runner. You had Rory Robinson, who's an Irish filmmaker, who did this incredible short film with CG. You had Neil Blomkamp, obviously, District 13. And then
District 9.
Yes. Yeah. And then the and then Gareth Edwards with Monsters, who then went on to do Rogue One and then went to director jail for no good reason. So you had this rich vein of like bedroom warriors who were able to turn out incredible results, and the studios just ate it up. So that's exactly where you landed. Yeah. And I remember I was just eating this up going, because I knew After Effects, but I wasn't really in that space. I was like, I can do this. I could totally do this. And I followed everything that these guys were doing. And you were right. Everything was getting shared on Vimeo. It was just blowing up. But Project Kronos, I remember it so well. You made it look sick. It still looks sick. I went back and watched it. It's like, it still looks fucking sick. It's so good. I'm like, I don't think anyone understands how hard it was to do that.
It's hard. It was hard. Yeah. But also, it was a learning curve for me because, like, you know, I made that short with the intention of, like, you know, it then became a proof of concept, which later eventually became the feature, The Beyond, which ended up going to Netflix and stuff. But, like, at the time, you know, it was my calling card. I end up getting signed to a really cool manager called Scott Glassgold, who end up repping a bunch of people. And by the way, I've met Rory Robinson in LA, like, because we were in the same circles, the whole video star pick. So, and there's a bunch of other, there's a guy called Stefan Solotsky who did True Skin. You know, the one about the AR components in the future, cyberpunkish kind of. And there's a bunch of, like, you know, Arne Nguyen, who did the Akira short. You know, these are all people in the same, like, group as me. Like, after the bunch that you mentioned, we kind of followed, got inspired by Gareth Edwards and Rory Robinson, all those amazing directors. And so we were, like, the next wave. And it was so obvious that, you know, we were doing these visual spectacle looking films with very high concept science fiction stories, but done on a very tiny budget, and really kind of broke out the Hollywood system. And so, of course, agents and managers were like, we got to nab, we got to rep you. How do we like commercialize this? And it's great for us because we're like, you know, this is our foot in the industry. We didn't have to do the whole festival route. But then, you know, very quickly you start to realize that you have to turn these shorts into products. And this is where, you know, you start getting signed to a studio. So with Project Kronos, there was a bidding war. I didn't even know what a bidding war was, like, until I read an article in Variety, which I screenshot a million times. I couldn't believe it's in Variety. And they were saying, yeah, a company called Bender Spink and Armory Films, which is the finance company, ended up optioning it. And for, you know, for those listening, optioning is like, it's like optioning a book. They pay you a little bit of money to take the rights for like 12 to 18 months, and it's exclusive to them, which means that whatever they develop within the 18 months, if it becomes a movie, then it happens. If it doesn't, then the rights revert back to you. So it was great. I got to like write the script, and I was like, not really a writer. I'm just a director that writes out of necessity. Also, as nothing gets made. But I remember my manager at the time was like, read this book. It's called Save the Cat. Everything you need to know. And I'm reading this thinking, it's so true. Like, it's all the tropes are in there. Your incitant incident, your three act structure, and all the notes you get back from the executives kind of reflects that. You're like, oh, that kind of makes sense.
Yes, we could do a whole episode on Save the Cat and how it's destroyed screenwriting. But, you know, let's not go there.
But simplified it. But what was interesting, we spent like 2 years trying to get the project off the ground, and I learned so much. You know, I got to work with amazing executives. I ended up getting writing gigs to like spec writing for Paramount, for Fox, and it was looking great on my CV. But 2 years go by, and I wake up one morning, getting ready to go to work. I was working at a visual effects company called Lex Hag, working on a show called Poldark. This is kind of period drama thing. I was a VFX producer on that. And why am I not behind the lens making a movie? Why am I still in visual effects? I'm going to my manager, I'm speaking to my agents, and they're like, well, you know, it's things take time. You're still green. You're still first-time director. I'm like, how long does this take? Just need to know. Because, well, it depends. You know, it could pop. It may not pop. But, you know, so I'm like, you know, screw this. So I had some money saved up, like, to buy a house, right? So you know where this is going. And I'm like, going to my partner, should I really buy a house, make a movie? Like, I don't know how long this is going to go. I know how to make this movie. You know, so my partner said, look, go make the movie. Just don't F it up, but go make the movie. And I go back to the studio.
But what does that mean, don't F it up, though? What did you set parameters on success? Like, did it need to go to a festival? Did it need to make money? I mean, oh, sorry.
Return of investment. I mean, oh, that's from my partner's point of view, because like, this is like, well, it's your own cash, right? And it probably the best decision I made in my career was to invest your own money. Because look, you don't waste anything. Like, if I'm shooting something, that's not going on the cutting floor. That's going in the movie, because that shit costs money. Okay. It costs my money, right?
So, I've lost my cluster. Can you tell me how much your budget was? Or do you prefer to not say?
I can't tell you some. I mean, I can tell you it was around 100K in total to make an entire feature film, The Beyond. I can safely say that now because it's been out for like several years. It's fine. But at the time, it was like no one must ever know. Yeah. And just so you'd give you some context. So like, so there was a turnaround moment. So turnaround means that when they renew your option. And they were like writing another check for me. Like, here's another check for a renew the option. I'm like, guys, what are we doing this? Because we're just going to keep development. It's like development hell, right? So I'm like, look, I've had a great time working on this script. And this script was like $35 million or plus. It was like ridiculous. It was so big. It was like Interstellar meets Gravity. It was insane. I had so much fun working on it. I learned so much how to write with a studio and how to deal with executives and notes. So it's like the best education you can get. But I need to make a movie. I'm still a first-time director. I need to move ahead. So I said, look, I'm going to not renew it. I'm going to take back the option. Obviously, I can't make the movie that you know you paid me to write, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take the short, which is 15 minutes. I'm going to make the 92 minute version of that short because I know how to make it. It's going to work. And they're like, fantastic. And they gave me all this great advice. And the biggest advice they gave was don't try to make a visual spectacle movie for low budget. It'll always look B. It'll always look a B movie because there's a reason why Marvel's Star Wars looked like that. You know, look at what Neil Blomkamp did with District 9, even though District 9 is a little bit more expensive to what I've done. But he focused on character, he focused on social commentary. You know, look at what, you know, like Monsters that Gareth Edwards did, right? You know, he was very guerrilla about it. It was shot in a very guerrilla way, but it had great story, great characters, yet had those level of spectacle, but not overblown visual effects, so like full CG shots. So I went off and did that, and you know, long story short, I ended up making a movie through 2016, 2017, and it came out in 2018 in January, and it got picked up by a distribution company called Gravitas Ventures, and it was number 2 in iTunes charts next to Blade Runner 2049 and Wonder Woman. And to me, that's a moment for me because Blade Runner is one of my all-time favorite movies, like, ever. So I'm like, oh, this is amazing. And this is a film with no cast, okay? There's no cast. It's fake documentary, and it's done in a very Blumhouse-esque style way. And then you get a sales report. So, when you sell a movie to a distributor, every quarter you get what you call a sales report. The sales report tells you how many places it's sold to, how much money it's made, how much percentage goes back to the distributor, how much you take, right? So typical revenue share model. And we were 300% in profit. So not only did I cover the cost of my movie, thank God, we were in profit. And then in September, bear in mind the movie came out in January 2018. In September, Netflix calls up the distributor and goes, we've seen this movie everywhere. And by the way, I am a bit of a press whore. I love promoting. I love writing articles. I'm in every magazine. And Netflix, why isn't this movie on Netflix? Like, what the hell? So they write out a check. And the way Netflix works is they don't give you royalties. They just do a one-off fee. It's like a buyout fee for like, but in our case, it was for 12 months, which means that after 12 months, like we still go and sell it elsewhere. So from a business point of view, it's fantastic. So with the money we made from that, first thing we did was we had a bunch of people that worked on the film, but they were on deferred or low payment. I didn't want people to work for free because I was very specific about being an artist. I've worked for free. I just didn't feel right. So they were working on like, you know, sort of like reduced fees or equity rate, as we call them. Some of the visual effects companies helped me out on some like rendering and stuff, which amazing they did. So I just went back to them and said, hey, listen, this is how much it should have cost. Can someone like send me an invoice? I want to pay for this. They're like, wait, what? I'm like, yeah, I've got some money for you. Got some money for you. They're like, this doesn't happen. No,
It doesn't happen.
I thought this should.
It doesn't happen.
It should though.
It doesn't happen.
I know, because I've worked on tons of music videos that deferred and never got any money back. And I just assumed that's the way it was. But I just assume when it's a contract, like when you've made something, I can't go tell people I've made a commercial hit when I got a bunch of people that were on deferred or minimal fees. So I went and just gave money back to everyone. And obviously that it feels good, but it also feels right to that's how it should be done. If you can, you should, right? So that felt good. And at the same time, I got my next movie greenlit. This was called Origin Unknown with the amazing Katie Sackhoff. And this was a movie that was supposed to be my first movie. Do you remember I told you when Project Kronos came out? It got a lot of traction. But of course, when you go to Hollywood and you go to these meetings, they always ask the famous question, what else have you got?
What's next?
And I'm like, wow, yeah. I've got this movie. Right. And I've got this movie. And I've got this movie that's set on Mars. And back then, if you mention a movie about Mars, they're like, oh, please don't. You know, the, you know, Red Planet didn't do too well. Last Days on Mars didn't do too well.
No.
You know, don't tell us. And then Ridley Scott goes and makes The Martian, which is a massive hit. And all of a sudden, like, everyone's like, hey, you know that script we turned down like a year ago? The one about Mars specifically. You still have that? So, and that got
Mars
greenlit right away.
So hot right now. Yes. Totally. It's a fickle business you've decided to work in.
I know. It's a trend. It's all a trend.
it's pretty funny because I made a feature in 2014-15, similar kind of budget to you. We went down the route of put a bunch of kids in a room and chop them up kind of thing, but we did a psychological horror film, and like literally within the 24, like the 12 months of us producing it, like the bottom dropped out of the horror market. It just died. Really? And it was one of the most depressing kind of experiences in my life, going to the Cannes film market and walking around the floor there. And if you've not been to Cannes Film Festival, it's amazing. And you used to have the top tier films all in,
yep,
in competition. But then there's the market, and you have about 5,000 films from all around the world, all vying for distribution and buyers and everything else. And it's just, you suddenly are aware of just how much product there is out there and how difficult it is for you to even just like be seen or be noticed, because the landscape of things has just very much changed. It's a sort of sobering experience. Well, I think what I'm hearing from you here is that there was a sense of looking to take back control of your own destiny by not renewing the option, moving on. And I think this is what happens to a lot of young filmmakers, that they see this moment in time where you know, you get heat. Agents talk about heat. And I'm sure you've had this as well, Lou. You get heat. Your agent goes, oh, I've got all these things for you. And you're like, I am amazing. I'm going to be Dermot O'Leary. I am. Or whoever.
That was my goal.
Insert name.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And then it doesn't happen. And you're like, what did I do wrong? And it's not that you did anything wrong. It's that agents fundamentally grin fuck you. They just tell you what you want to hear. And that's basically how it works. Sorry.
Did you just say grin fuck you? I mean, that is like, wow, I've never heard that one before. I'm going to use that one.
It's so good, right? It's so good. That's what they do. And then you know that they're on the phone to someone else going, no, not this guy. No.
The first time you hear that, you thoroughly believe it as well. Yeah. I was like,
it's brutal.
I've not said anything on this podcast for about 15 minutes, mainly because I was thoroughly enjoying just a schooling on filmmaking there, and very interesting for sure. I think my role is going to be to slowly curve to the metaverse.
Yes.
And at what point in your story did Hazimation come along? I know Rift is a really interesting story because then you got to the Epic grant, and then slowly Unreal Engine started becoming a big part of your journey. Yeah. So is that what happened next? Are we at
Well, yeah. I mean, when I was making my second movie, Origin Unknown, you know, with Katie Sackhoff, and it was a proper movie. It wasn't like, you know, The Beyond, which is very scrappy and guerrilla, and, you know, this was like, had a film set and everything, is all of that stuff. And it was a bigger budget as well. It was like something like 1.2 mil or something. And I remember it was an interesting take, because I had a very specific way on how I wanted to get stuff done in a very efficient way. But the producers, who are amazing, by the way, had a very specific way they do things, which is very legacy-based and stuff. I'm like, really? It's going to take this long to set a camera? Can we just stick a GoPro or something? Like, no, it'll take time. So they brought on a post-producer called Paula Crickard, and she's a veteran. She's worked like on Harry Potter. She's worked on Fantastic Beasts. She way back in the early 90s, she was making movies as a producer. And, you know, the last movie she just finished called Expendables 4. So she's done all that. And she came on, and she's the complete opposite to me. Because I'm like, yeah, we're going to make a movie. She'd be like, let's read the small print. She's that person, right? And after that, we realized both of us had worked as hired director. Well, I'm a hired director and she's a hired producer. And we got to the point where we're like, do we want to continue making stuff for other producers? Should we really focus on creating our own content? Like, maybe we should do that now. Like, we won't know until we do. And I've always wanted a business partner, but I didn't know what was the best business partner to have. And I realized, oh my God, Paula's perfect, because she's the complete opposite to me, but we share the same thing, which is good story, good characters, and commercial products. That's what we want to do. We don't want to make arty films, although they're great, which is not what we want to do. So we decided, let's set up a company. And so we set up a company called Hazfilm, which is essentially the vehicle for me to like get all my scripts into development and stuff. And with the money we had made from The Beyond, you know, put that in there. And then the pandemic hit. The pandemic hit, and we had one project called Luna, which was about to shoot in Gran Canaria. We were casting for that. We're talking to all the CAAs, all of the WMEs, agents and stuff, and all of a sudden, no actors are taking any deals, like no financiers want to like part of cash. They don't know what the landscape is, and Hollywood is like, stand still. We're like, shit. But here's the thing. I was already prepping the movie. And when I say prepping, I don't just mean storyboards. I'm talking previs, right? And for those listening, previs is kind of like a moving storyboard, but all done on a computer in 3D to really block out the sequence, see what it looks like before you shoot it. And I was using Unreal Engine for that. Unreal Engine 4.8, I think it was, something like really old.
What year is this?
Oh, man, this is early 2019.
Early 2019, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then like 2020, officially pandemic hit hardcore, right? So I was using like an early version of Unreal, and I was showing these previs to studio executives at the time, trying to get financing, get the deal going, even showing to sales companies, went to AFM and EFM and those crazy markets, like you said, they are literally a market. And just showing on your iPad, before the pandemic hit, we're like, this is what we're going to make. And they're like, what are we watching? I'm like, previs. They're like, no, we've seen previs. Previs is just gray, blocky, very steppy. That looks like either a video game cinematic or a first pass animated film. I'm like, no. They're like, okay. And then I remember going on a plane thinking, has anyone made an actual movie in Unreal? Because like, I can't be the only one thinking this. And I'm asking everyone. Everyone's like, yeah, you could, but no one's doing that because like, that's not the way you make animated films. You don't do it in a game engine. Are you mad? It's going to look like a game. So I started doing a bunch of test shorts. I did one called Battle Suit for a comic book company, which was a proof of concept. And I got asked by a company in LA called Pathfinder to do a proof of concept for Mutant Year Zero, which is the film we end up making now, going into production. But like, back then it was just a sizzle trailer and all done in Unreal. And we're getting a lot of coverage from Epic Spotlight and the press. And then I'm like, you know what? We don't know when this pandemic's going to be over. Why don't we just make a 93-minute animated feature film in Unreal Engine? And this is like Unreal Engine 4.22 or 4.20 now, because we kind of upgraded. They upgrade very fast, by the way.
And this is the moment where Haz from 2023 would like to go back to Haz from 2019 and explain to them all the reasons why nobody had done it before, because they will be numerous and painful. And you're like, yes, I am a pioneer and I have the scars. Am I right? Am I sort of in the ballpark?
You saw him in the ballpark, and I think thinking about it now, I can see the reason why a lot of people were like, really? You're going to make... Because when you say it out loud, right? We're going to make an animated feature film commercial in a video game engine. People just think, oh, Machinima or Red versus Blue, Halo, right? They're not thinking of the stuff that you can see today, which is gorgeous. Even an episode in Love, Death and Robots in one of the seasons had an episode done in Unreal. But back then, people didn't think that, right? So that was the challenge I found. So what we ended up doing was we ended up just going in our treasure trove. As with most production companies, you can appreciate, you have a bunch of projects in development. You write a one-page treatment. One day you go make that. You do a pitch deck, you shelve it. So when you do go in a meeting with a sales company, there's other projects you can show, right? And there was this one project called Brother, which is an outline of an idea I had where, this big brother tries to break out his little brother out of a medical facility because his little brother has special powers. Think Akira meets The Raid. And it was that kind of vibe, but it was unshootable. We wrote like a 50-page treatment I wrote, and my producing partner, Paula, was like, that's unshootable, right? Like, maybe if you make it to like James Cameron level, you could potentially shoot that. So we shelved it. So when it came to making an animated film, we're like, why don't we take the most unshootable thing and make that into animation? Because if you look at Spider-Verse, that can only exist in an animation medium because it just respects that medium so well. So we wanted to find a project and we did that. And what we did was we just did the first 10 minutes. We just went ahead, me and Andrea Detecci, my head of CG, we just went ahead. This was like October 2020. We built some assets really rough and just put it in the game engine. And I was doing a presentation online and Epic saw it. And Epic were like, so you're making a feature film in Unreal? Do you want some help?
How long did that take?
to do the 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I would say... We were just mocking assets up in iClone, like characters and stuff, and then just getting that kitbash assets together just to get something going. I think that took like 2 to 3 months in general, just like get something going, lit properly, rendered out and everything.
That's still really fast. If you went to like a traditional animation pipeline and said, course. Yeah, we're going to be three months to do that. It'd be pretty crazy. The thing that I think woke everybody up was the moment that they saw, I think it was 2019, a guy walks up to a motorbike and there's an LED wall behind him. And it's like,
oh yeah, that was the GDC presentation.
Yeah, yeah, a SIGGRAPH. And you suddenly heard about this thing called virtual production.
Yes.
And like virtual production, LED walls. And like, what's on the LED walls? Oh yeah, it's coming from Unreal Engine. Then you see people with tablets sliding things around. You're like, Unreal Engine? Are you, what? It's a game engine. And you had this weird 3D community snobbery. I think that's probably what it was, which is like, but are you telling me that it's real time? But yeah. I spent all this money on Octane Renderer, and we render in the cloud because then we can get absolutely 100% accurate simulations of light passing through glass. It's not that. It's not that. How could it possibly be that? It's we're like, well, yeah, but I mean, as an independent filmmaker, you're always confronted by cheap, fast, good. You can't have all three. You've got to pick two. And weirdly, somewhere in all of this is the ability to have all three. Because of a game engine. And I just think that's the thing that no one had really wired themselves up to appreciate that it can be that.
But yeah, it does have its pros and cons though, working in a game engine, of course. Like, you know, working in a game engine is like making a game where there is a bunch of variables. And also you've got to remember, Unreal Engine isn't a fully fledged product. It is constantly, it's like a game that's constantly getting patched, right? It's like a work in progress. It just keeps getting better and better and better. It's the best way. You know, when you install Unreal Engine, it says install at your own risk, right? Like, and so people are using it to do like, to make games, of course, but to do an animated feature film. You know, there's a whole load of things you have to think about. Like, for example, like, wait, do we have to pay royalties when we release our movie? Because you do have to pay a percentage royalties if you make $1 million on your game at Epic, right? For using Epic Unreal Engine on Game Store or something. But what about movies? And there wasn't anything like that for movies. So you need to get a release form from Epic to say that. There's a lot of stuff, as we all know, producing independent films that you still need to have those things. And also, what are we rendering in? Are we rendering EXTAR's 10-bit? Will that work with a color pipeline, which is ACES, in order to conform to proper deliverables for like Apple, Netflix, and so on?
We need a little klaxon nerd alert. I mean, you've gone so deep there. You've gone so deep.
Oh my god! Sorry.
Aces. Oh my god. Yes. I can't believe you were throwing that. And like, for anyone listening, it's just like properly faithful color accurate representation in the biggest color space you can get. That's kind of what Aces is. Yeah, basically, it's nice. Like Dolby for color.
You're like my walking dictionary, dude. Yeah, I'm just going to get you to define everything.
But I'm here for you, fam. I've got you.
There you go. So there was a lot we learned about that. But while we were making Rift, we got approached by a metaverse company called X Mana. Now, X Mana had seen a lot of the stuff we were posting. And just going to say, by the way, one of the reasons why I've been getting a lot of traction as a filmmaker, as a creator, and now my company, is because we constantly show stuff online. We constantly share stuff. You know, like, you got to keep sharing stuff because no one's going to find your work and no one's going to discover you if you don't share. Like, I have a lot of amazing filmmaker friends that are like way better at filmmaking than I could ever be. They're so good, but they don't want to share. They're like, oh, it's not ready. I'm like, put stuff out, put an image out. People need to know you're making stuff. So we were posting a lot of like work in progress for Rift, and we were doing a lot of keynotes, showing a lot of behind the scenes, you know, like became friends with like Matt Workman and Jonathan Wimbush, and you know, we're collaborating, sharing stuff on each other's social channels. And then X Mana reached out and said, listen, like, we're a Web3 company, we're doing NFTs, we're doing this blockchain project. All of the words that I did not want to hear at the time because I had no understanding. I'm like, oh my God, NFTs. Wait, isn't that a crypto thing? No, I don't know, man. I'm a creator. I don't deal with that. And they're like, no. You have to worry about that. We just want you to create a trailer to visualize the future of the metaverse, specifically the X Mana metaverse. And we're like, oh, yeah, we could do that. So, but at the same, and they had this amazing pitch that they had created, which was literally Ready Player One. And literally, I mean, dude, the amount of Web3 pitch decks I've seen, which is literally just visualizing what Ready Player One is. I'm like, dude, seriously, it's a movie. We're not right there. We've got the foundation, but we're not right there yet. So we end up creating this 2.5-minute sizzle trailer. Released it. It's online. Did really well in all the Web3 community. And we got back some feedback from the guys at X Mana, specifically Steve Stein, who's this amazing CEO there. He goes, we want to do 5 more of these videos. I'm like, oh, I mean, that's great business, but why? They're like, well, because we want to show gamification for a retailer. We want to show gamification for this and that and all of that stuff. You know, showing how you can buy outfits and commercialize via tokenism, all of the buzzwords for Web3, right? I'm like, okay, yeah, I get that. But let me get this right. Web3 is immersive and interaction of, it's an immersive internet, right? It's the next level of the internet experience. Web2 is video and imagery, and Web1 is text, for my
understanding. Well, no, not really. Not really. In a nutshell, Web3 is about ownership. It's about returning ownership to...
Sure,
so
sure.
And it's a self-sovereign thing. The interactivity, is, yes. All that stuff, it's an experience level, and that really belongs in the metaverse. Yeah,
100%. And that's what I was referencing, like in terms of the experience that they're trying to show in these videos. They're trying to show what the experience is. And I'm like, to my understanding, the experience is like it's more immersive in Web3 as opposed to Web2. Whereas Web2, you have video and text and imagery. So I was like, look, instead of using Web 2 approach to show the future of Web 3, why don't you just show it in Web 3? They're like, well, how do we do that? I'm like, well, it's funny you should say that. The video that we created for you, that animated trailer, that's all done in Unreal Engine. They're like, what? I'm like, yeah, it's done in the game engine. They're like, no, we thought you did this like, you know, Maya or some Autodesk software and pre-render. I'm like, yeah, it's rendered, but it's created in a game engine. So why don't we just spend a bit of time migrating that project into a game project in Unreal, it's all in Unreal in the same ecosystem, just a different setup, and plug a controller in and do some blueprints and then walk around what we've built already. And it blew their minds. It blew their minds. And they're like, oh my God, we can do that. And all of a sudden we're getting it into the Web3 world, because now they're like, you guys have to be the ones to create Xlantis, which is a big open world metaverse that they want to create. That is to do with esports, and they've had a bunch of like soccer teams signed up and so on. You guys have to do that. I'm like, okay, but we don't do engineering, server code. You know, we can create games. You know, we're doing an Xbox game, you know, that we got signed with Microsoft Xbox ID program, but this is a whole different thing. Because no, it'll be a collaboration. So we end up coming on board as the lead creative studio on it. And we're not making single Xlantis. But the way we approached it, we didn't approach it like we're making a Web3 experience. Like, we knew the end product is the Web3. For the team, you have to inspire the team. And I just couldn't go to my team and go, we're going to be making a Web3 game, everyone. And I'm like, wait, what? We thought we signed up to make some like console games. So what we said was, we're making an MMO. That's what we're doing. We're making an MMO, which is going to be delivered as a Web3 experience. And they bought into it. It was great. And as a studio, we end up learning so much about the potential of Web3, which I still believe is going to be the most amazing thing if done right, as for everything. But also, like, we got involved like with things like NFTs. And again, generating NFTs, generating variations of NFTs, making sure there's utility attached to those things. We start to learn. Start to be a kind of like a controlling shareholder in that project. And here's the thing. We did the first prototype. It was just like a Zoom call. I was playing around, showing them. They're like, this is amazing. Like, can you send us the link to play? I'm like, well, yeah, what computer have you got? Do you have like an RTX, NVIDIA RTX? Like, no, we just have a phone and an iPad. Because these are tech venture capital like executives, right? They don't have like, or maybe their kid have an RTX machine. So I'm like, oh. Then we looked at pixel streaming. Now, there's no way in the world we would have looked at pixel streaming, which for those listening, is basically running Unreal Engine on an instance of a server on the cloud, and you send that link to whoever you want, and they could play that via streaming, just like Microsoft Xbox Game Pass does, right? You know, you can stream the content via your iPad. All of a sudden,
I'm just gonna sidebar this bit because pixel streaming is quite complicated to set up, but it's insane. It's like, if we can figure out the piping and the user experience, it's going to be how the metaverse is delivered.
100%.
Yeah. Mm.
100%. Also for VR, surely as well.
100%. Yeah. Like,
that's good enough. That it's all good.
You look at what's happening with NVIDIA and Omniverse. It's not that far away. It's nuts.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I mean, of course, things like the cost of streaming is still pretty high. Like, you know, to get an AWS Amazon server instance, obviously we didn't cover that cost. They did, but you can tell that, you know, when we're looking at the bandwidth spendage, like, wow, you know, we have to figure out a better way of doing this that is a bit more cost efficient. If you expect to have millions of people hit that server, you know, you're going to need to be like League of Legends level, like in terms of managing a server for that sort of game. So, but it was great. And, you know, we end up jumping to this other project by Uppercut, which is an NFT project called Jumpcut. And again, like, you know, we were creating these characters, but then we were creating sort of like tools inside of Unreal to help customize characters in a very automated way that then allows us to spit out variations of those characters. And again, like 2 years ago at the time, I would never imagine we'd be building tools inside of Unreal, because I just thought we're going to create movies in Unreal. Now we're making games in Unreal. We're doing Web3 experiences in Unreal. We're doing NFTs at the time. It just shows you, like, you know, you build a workflow with real time in the center. The possibilities of all the various verticals, all the various end results products you can create, all comes from that central real time pipeline. You're not hacking different bits of pipeline to make it work. It all comes, you know, you use like Blender, you use whatever tool you want to use to create your assets. But once it comes in Unreal, it's an Unreal ecosystem. And that's what fascinated me.
How do you feel about the sort of the landscape now then? Because you talked through the traditional sort of filmmaking experience and then sort of realized, okay, if we're building, making short films in Unreal, then I guess you've got like the assets from the film that it kind of naturally can kind Correct. Of lead over into like maybe like a game experience Correct. Now. So they're categories that have always existed, but yeah. There is sort of like a new media category of
yes
that coming together. No?
Yes. I mean, you're kind of alluding to what transmedia they call it. And basically, when we were making our feature film, Rift, you know, there was a car chase scene I wanted to do. And I thought, oh my God, we're not like freaking Pixar level animation to get all the weight of a car and suspension. So I remember working on Colin McRae Rally for Codemasters back in the day.
What a game. Yes, I was hoping you were going to bring it up.
That was for you, Luke. but yeah, I remember working on that, and I did cinematics at Codemasters. And I remember like, the suspension, like the Subaru suspension, just the weight of a car when it takes a drift around the corner. All these things have to be thought of, like from an animation point of view to the physics point of view. I'm like, oh my God. So what we did was we end up plugging the controller in Unreal and just driving a car around and kind of like observing how the physics is and baking some of that stuff in sequencer so that we have some animation to play with. And we realized, hang on, this was so fun. What if we control a character? So we move the character around. What if we made a game? Because here's the thing, one of the most expensive resources in game development is the assets, right? It's the art, it's the motion capture, it's all the things, that, all the ingredients to make that game. And then there's the code. But we've spent 2 years building these assets, doing the motion capture, doing all this stuff. So why don't we spend a bit of time focused on the code and the game design? So we end up doing an offshoot of the game. And that eventually became what we call Max Beyond, which is now going to be at Gamescom in a week's time in Germany, and we're showing that. And Microsoft saw the early Steam demo we released, and they signed us up for the Independent Developers Program. So from there, it just shows you that you could, you know, now it's not new making a movie into a game, of course, but the way we're doing it is we build once and repurpose several times. And I think that's where the smart transmedia use is.
Which probably brings us quite nicely onto Fortnite and what they're building out with the creative and Unreal Engine Fortnite editor and stuff.
Yeah.
So yes, that's the natural thing, because obviously it's all built on Unreal. All the stuff you talked about makes sense in a Fortnite setting with the massive distribution platform that is Fortnite. We've talked about that a lot on the show, but we'll talk about Moontopia in a second, which is your game that you just released on the platform, which is excellent. By the way, it's very cool. So yeah, how are you thinking about that opportunity? And yeah, maybe you could talk us through Moontopia, because it's a really good demonstration of all those things.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, you guys know already that I was doing Exelantis, right? And the pain that we had in creating every single component, like we had to create a token system. We had to create ways to get like 20 plus people running in there. We had to, it was like everything you thought of, you had to build it, right? And then you have Fortnite, where it's already, all the mechanics are built there for you. You got to focus on just really good game design and optimization. So I was at the Game Developers Conference in March this year. I was in the Epic event, and Tim Sweeney comes up and he's like Steve Jobs, like on everyone's like, woo! And then they showed UEFN. And there was three things that stood out for me and pretty much everyone in that room as well, which was, holy shit, we can bring our own content into Fortnite, like our own environments that doesn't need to look like Fortnite, we can do that. Second, we can monetize our content. like the split's like 80-20, I think, like 80 creator, 20 back to Epic. Like, or, holy shit.
If only it's 40%. You need to check your numbers when it comes to...
It's still good. Yeah. It's still good, though. Yeah, it's still very, very good. Like, compared to all the other places, like, you know, like Roblox and so on. Like, you know, this is like a really... It's a great way to commercialize your project. But also, lastly, 500 million plus user base on Fortnite. And growing, pretty sure. So, from an independent creator point of view, where our sole existence in the company is creating original IP... Isn't this a great way to test your IP, to get eyeballs on your IP? So I'm like, we've got to do something. So I came back to London. I told the team, like, you guys seen UEFN? They're like, yeah, it's Fortnite, dude. I'm like, yeah, but there's something about it. So we realized, look, if we're going to do something in Fortnite, it's got to be original IP. We cannot just make a mock-up level or a mock-up demo, because that just becomes like all the other really cool islands out there. And you got to remember, you know, to make making UGC content in Fortnite isn't new. It's been happening for years, you know, using creator mode. The only difference is all the islands look the same because you have to use the Fortnite creator mode, which is their own assets and everything, right? So that's why it all looks the same. But with this, you get to create your own world. Now, of course, there are restrictions in Fortnite. You can't change a player character because obvious reasons, because, you know, Fortnite makes money on the skins and so on. And there's a few other limitations, like you can only have 400 megabytes for your entire game. Your entire game cannot go more than 400 megabytes. So you have to be very smart on the sort of game experience you make. So what we did was we're like, okay, we want to create original IP. It takes a long time to create original IP from the ground up, as we could all appreciate on this call. So remember I mentioned we have a bunch of projects that we develop and we shelve. Well, we had one project called Moontopia, which we were developing as an animated series, all in Unreal, which we did in Unreal Engine 5, a trailer. We showed at Annecy Animation Festival last year as a kind of like a presentation. And it was essentially about a bunch of astronauts, space tourist astronauts, crash land on the moon. They have to make their way to the Moontopia base to get the only ship available to go back to Earth. In between that, there are monsters on the moon. So it's Gravity meets A Quiet Place set on the moon. That was essentially the show premise. We're like, that actually makes a really cool Fortnite game, because with Fortnite game, you can play solo, but also you can play with a group of people, competitive and team, all doing the same thing, trying to get to the end point, right? And for survival. So we migrated all of the assets from the Moontopia Unreal Engine 5 animated series project into UEFN. So again, transmedia again, same approach we did to Rift, and we started building it. And all of a sudden, we're like, we're going to make a fully fledged game. This is a great way to make a fully fledged game. Know your limits, obviously, because it's Fortnite. But yeah, it took us like a month to learn UEFN. It does. I mean, for those listening, UEFN, Unreal Editor Fortnite, is basically Unreal Engine 5.1 Lite. Okay, so it's still Unreal Engine, but except lots of stuff being stripped out. So when we migrated some of our Niagara is the big particle fire smoke effects. When we moved that into UEFN, it all broke, because obviously it's not complete Niagara, but it does have all the bells and whistles of Unreal Engine 5, like Lumen Lighting, which is the gorgeous photorealistic global illumination lighting. You have things like World Partition, that some voodoo magic it does that allows you to create massive worlds and it breaks up into chunks to stream it through. And I mean, and then you have Nanite, which is like, it deals with hundreds of thousands of polygons in a smart way. So you have that, but you still have to optimize.
You didn't say the best bit. It's free.
it's free. Of course, and it's free. There's literally no reason.
Yeah, think about how much you're spending on an Adobe subscription every month. Unreal Engine is,
I know, right?
Unreal Engine is free.
I know.
It blows my mind.
And it keeps getting better. Yeah, it keeps getting better as well. Like, I mean, we're on like 5.3 or 5.4 now. Like, it's ridiculous. Like,
well, I think but what's good about it, because it is free, it's like Blender, that there's like a heap of tutorials from people who are also experimenting and building. You mentioned Jonathan Winbush, Matt Werman, also people I looked up to, Matt Werman in particular. But like, there are people out there who are sharing what they're learning because it's free. It's an Epic. They're not perfect, but they do a lot of things really well that make it possible for younger and younger people to dip a toe and start experimenting and making games, and then building a community around that. I think that's really, really positive.
I think so.
And I think for me, one of the best things about Fortnite is I don't need to explain to anybody how to play it. I don't need to write a bunch of instructions. Great. It's just like, oh, it's in Fortnite. What's the code? Go.
Exactly.
Go. That's it. And that is like, I don't know. working in Web3, working in crypto, working in NFTs, working in the metaverse, there's always this look on people's faces like... And then it's like a half-hour conversation to explain why you're not a scam. And then you're like, but you... And Fortnite, there's none of that. There's none of that. So you can just kind of get to work in a sensible way. And like you said, you know, 70 million monthly active users and growing rapidly. You think about, they just come for the Battle Royale, but now they're coming for your game. They're coming for a Ralph Lauren experience. They might be going there for, you know, a Travis Scott concert or a Kid Leroy concert. All this stuff. Like, we really are witnessing the birth of what will be the next Facebook. But I think the thing that you there's so many things to pick up on to wrap to kind of just at least give people some actionable things from this. But it's the build once, use everywhere. And what you've been talking about is build once, but use everywhere, kind of across Unreal Engine stuff. But like, it's not going to be like that for long. This kind of myth of interoperability, the OpenUSD standards, the Alliance for OpenUSD, which will allow like universal scene description, which is the Pixar format that allows complex 3D scenes to be read by all sorts of different types of software. It's going to be basically the JavaScript or the HTML for the metaverse. And it's happening right now because the companies that are active in the metaverse, even though they're in competition with each other, recognize the need for everything to flow through the same channels.
Correct.
Which means that your assets that you build that are usable in Fortnite and Unreal Engine will be usable on the Apple Vision Pro, in That's Roblox, awesome. In VR, in AR, everywhere.
Everywhere.
Welcome to the future.
That is an important point. I have a question. We'll leave the Moontopia Island code, obviously, in the description as well. We'd encourage people to go and check it out.
Yes, please do. It's awesome.
Yeah, for sure. I was going to ask, from obviously there's the, you know, you're trained for years and years, both of you in filmmaking, and there's that kind of high-end side of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's interesting having seen like Only Up, like viral games that are quite simple. And for someone like me who doesn't, I try and learn Unreal Engine to the best of my ability, but it is obviously hard and it takes time. But I know there's a whole wave of like new creators coming up who want to learn how to do stuff simply. What would be your kind of best advice to someone who's obviously made games? And also, I don't know if you can shed any light on, if you're happy to, like how you make money. I know there's this 40% split from Epic, but is that on engagement time, do you know, or is that
it's based on player retention? I mean, I'll definitely let you guys know in about just over a month's time when we get our metric report back. But what's really cool is, you know, when you create an account to become what you call a Fortnite creator, you submit your tax information to Epic. They have to validate you, especially if you're a company. They have to validate you, make sure you know you're not a scammer and that kind of thing, which is good, right? So they should check. Once you do that, and then when you publish your game on the official published server, they do more validation checks to make sure there's no logos in there, music that's not supposed to be in there. And once that's there, then you get a report website that comes up with all the traction. It tells you that how much metrics, how many people, and it's all player retention. So the longer people stay in your map, the better, but also the more players, more unique players come in, the better. Also, if someone's buying a Fortnite skin because they're playing your game, that counts as part of your monetization. But we don't know. In fact, like, I had a conversation with guys at Epic the other day, and they're like, let us know like what your metrics are, because like we are one of the first. I think there's another company called Bronze Studios that released an experience in UEFN, but I don't know if it was monetized. But and there are a bunch of other people doing smaller stuff, but I think we're one of the first that created like, you know, a beginning, middle, end, a full-on game where you start, there's a story, you release, you go out in the end, and voila, done. It's not like a gimmicky map or anything like that. But also, we built it in a way that you can expand as well, so that we can have, you know, we can expand it like a game. Like, you know, instead of going across the lunar surface, we can go underneath the lunar surface. There's a whole alien cave, and there's a space elevator. But all of that is dependent on how the metrics look. So yeah, so I'll definitely let you guys know how it does. For sure.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, no, that's good to know. And you said that as well, like your game, I know we're short on time, but there is like a linear storyline, right? Because you've built a whole fully 3D explorable world, but I imagine it's smart to have some sort of progression through it so people play through and they stay for longer and sort of complete something.
Yes,
like that.
We've put a lot of Easter eggs in, of course. I mean, Sam Rebello, who's our level. So what happened was I mocked up the original version of the game myself, just mocked it up just so that I can pitch it to the team, say, hey, do you guys want to play, be in this world? And then Sam came in and he kind of really did a really smart level design based on what I wanted. And when I say what I want, I basically mocked up a version and he made it better, which was amazing. But one thing we wanted to do was we didn't want to have text saying, go left, go right, or this is where you should go. We also didn't want people to rely on the waypoint system so much. So we designed the level in a way that it kind of felt, you had the feeling to turn that way. You had the feeling to go this way. And that is just level design 101, I guess, right? So using visual iconic moments, like there's a big monster in front of you, you're not going to go there, you're going to go that way, or you're going to destroy it and then go for it to go that way. So we've done it in that way. But if you're playing solo play, then of course you want to follow the narrative straight through. But if you're playing multiplayer, you still want to get to the end, but it's really who gets the most keys, who gets to the moon base first. And there's still a story. And we did a full 2-minute cinematic, by the way, like myself and Mark Cheng, who's this amazing creator I work with. We did a full cinematic and we realized no one in Fortnite's going to watch 2-minute cinematic. They're going to press X. Look at that. So we did a compressed version, which ended up being way better. But here's the thing, guys, when you make cinematics in Fortnite, you have to be very aware that when we make cinematics pre-rendered, you have a lot of control, right? In Unreal, because you say when certain things go and you render it to frame. In a game, it's very different. So when you play the game, when you get to the end, you go into the spaceship takes off, and you go towards Earth. We were playing multiplayer, and two of my colleagues were still shooting at me while my character's in the ship, and I got killed. I got eliminated while in the ship. In the cinematic, that says congratulations. It's funny. It's a bug, but we're like, you know what? It's cool. It's the charm of Fortnite. You can do that. So yeah.
Yeah. That's so funny. That's cool. Yeah. Nice. I feel like we could talk for hours more. I'm conscious of time because we only have booked an hour with you. But
that's okay.
I guess to sort of begin wrapping up is, you've painted such a good picture of how everything's developed. What are you mainly focused on now? You're still across all of these media categories. Fortnite is obviously a big opportunity. Yeah. Feels like a pretty amazing time for it all. So what would you like to tell people about? What's getting you really excited?
Well, I mean, I'm currently the cinematics director on this game called Dune for Funcom, based on the big movie. And that's all I can say because my NDA is like ridiculous. But you can, I think they released an early trailer like at the Games Award in January this year. So you can just type in Dune Awakening, you'll see. And I'm the cinematics director on that. And my production company, Hasmation, is doing all cinematics for that. And we start pre-production on our next animated movie called Mutant Year Zero, which is also based on the video game IP. So we're in full mode on that. We've set up a studio in Ireland for that, so we can tap into the Irish teams and the tax incentives, all of that beautiful stuff. We obviously are expanding Moontopia. We are in the middle of distribution for Rift. So hopefully Rift comes out early next year, depending on distribution deal we come up with. And we've got two games that we're taking to GamesCon. One of them is Max Beyond, which is a spin-off, which is part of the IDEA Xbox program. So we have dev kits from Microsoft, which is bizarre. We actually have Xbox dev kits. And we've got another game called Synchromania, which is also a spin-off from Rift, which is the bad... When you watch the movie, you'll see there's a bad robot in there. We thought we'd give it its own game. And we're doing a bunch of other tests. Like, as a company, we have our sole purpose, which is making original content in film, television, video games. But as we've all explained today, the world of transmedia allows you to have multiple verticals, means that as a company, it's very exciting because if you get financing from an investor, the investor isn't just putting all its money in one basket. It's like, oh, if we invest in this game, there's a potential movie spinoff, there's a potential comic book spinoff, there's potential all this stuff. So the return on investment is a little bit higher as opposed to one. So that's kind of like, it's a really interesting, we're not the only ones doing it. There's a bunch of other studios doing that. And I think that's where we are. So I think next year, if I speak to you, you guys will say, what are you up to? I'm like, well, we did a VR experience now because the VR market is just perfect and right for this story. That's how it is, man.
How big is your team?
Our team is 8 and we're ramping up to 12. During Rift, we had 12 to 15 because we ramp up and down. So we have a core team. There's myself, there's Paula Crickard, my producer, Andrea Tedeschi, who's our head of CG, who's responsible for pipeline and blueprint. Guy's a genius. We have Sam Rebello, who's in charge of art, environment and art. We have Ryan and Ernesto, who's our devs. You notice we've kind of skewed more towards devs because we're making more games. And then whenever our projects come in, we start to ramp up massively and ramp back down, but our core team's always the same.
Nice. Very, very cool. I'll let you have the final word, Robin, but thank you, Haz, so much.
Like, pleasure.
So interesting and so much cool, like, actionable stuff in there as well, and lots of good opportunities.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess I recognize in what you've been doing something that I recognize in myself, which is I sort of cast myself as a filmmaker, and I did that for a long time and shot commercials and all these kind of things where you're around film making and the kind of pageantry of filmmaking is really fun. Like, production is really fun. If you're that kind of person, it's really good. But what I realized was that really I'm a storyteller, and a story can be all sorts of different things and in all sorts of different mediums. And actually, as long as you're enjoying that, it can be a video game, it can be a piece of animation, it can be anything. And that's the constant that runs through all of this. I really appreciate the fact that you took back control of your own destiny here and you followed something that really wasn't obvious 4 years ago. It started to become more obvious and more people took it on. But I think anyone who picked up Unreal Engine expecting it to be the next evolution of what DSLRs were back in 2011, 12, where suddenly democratization of film tools was with everyone. Unreal Engine is not that. It's very, very hard. It takes time. It's not just pick up and shoot. But you did it anyway. So that taking back control of your own destiny and following where things were interesting and hot rather than what Hollywood was telling you to do, I really appreciate that. You've talked about the challenge of IP. Standing up your own IP is very, very difficult, but it is the most valuable thing that you can own 100%. And have. So if you can make it stick, particularly now we have a platform like Fortnite where you can deliver your own IP and deliver it using mechanics that you don't have to build yourself. That's sick. I look at the games that are going hot right now. They're all built with like off the shelf library assets from Fortnite, which is fine. But the real game, the thing that you can then continue to build on, you know, game after game, it's going to be your own IP. So that,
absolutely,
if you can do that early and bed it into people's kind of habits on Fortnite, particularly, will be a big deal. We've also talked about discovery here. So you've mentioned it in passing that you are a publicity whore, but there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. Like the people, you know, the people who are on TikTok or on Instagram are publicity whores. They go out and promote their stuff. And it's actually the thing that you mentioned that really resonated is that there's this idea of a tortured artist that sits in a loft and turns out one page every 6 months and it's perfection. And that just doesn't work. There's a need for feedback loops in the work that we do, particularly in creative, and you've got to be open to that. You've got to kind of park your ego at the door. And I love the fact that you're so very open about that because it's going to make your feedback cycles much faster and learn and iterate much faster. And anyone that's kind of looking to do like one short film every 2 years, you're just not going to learn very much. You've got to kind of get your foot in the door. And like what we've learned from putting our own virtual production studio together is like, I can go anywhere in the world. I can be anywhere and I can experiment. Yeah. And yes, it's hard, but mastering that and then getting to a point where we can use it whenever we want saves us so much money and gives us an opportunity to really put stuff out there. So discovery, I think that's the main thing here. Discovery, discovery, discovery. Make yourself discoverable. Yeah. Because 100%. If you put things out into the universe, stuff comes back. And I think that's the biggest lesson that any creative can learn. So don't be shy to put stuff out there.
Yeah.
And then there's this other idea that you're creating stories you can play. Yes. I love that. I love that. That is, it's so very reflective of the way audiences are now. They engage with things in a completely different way. And I think in your VentureBeat piece, you specifically mentioned that and called it out. Absolutely, 100%. And then I just think there's so many different ways to skin a cat and different ways to tell a story. But where so much of like the film industry is starting to eat itself, because of AI, what you're doing
is supercharged. About AI. Oh my God.
It's supercharged by AI. That. You're in like a perfect position to like be even leaner, even faster because you've seen that opportunity. So I think so many things for anyone to take from where you've come from and where you are now.
Thanks, man.
So I hope this is a genuinely useful conversation for anyone's kind of looking to be inspired, because you've been at this for quite a long time and it's just always been like the true through line through all
and
of
it's
it.
Hard it is hard. It isn't like you said, you don't just pick up Unreal and go, hey, I'm gonna make a hit and that's it. It's like any piece of art you do, whether it's music or writing a book, you know, it's very iterative. You know, you gotta have a very agile workflow. If we made Rift in a very traditional way, like, you know, get a sign off on animatics and then move on to lighting, and we wouldn't have be able to make for that money. But also, as an artist, I'm constantly discovering myself, you know, like I didn't realize that I had the storytelling chops to do a full-on action movie like Rift, because my last two films were very cerebral sci-fi, right? And through iteration and being bold and trying new things out, learning new technology, and that's the thing I remind people, is that I got to the point in my career, you know, having directed a full TV show on Disney Plus called Fast Lane and EP'd on it as well. I was at the point where I could have been like other directors at that level by saying, yeah, I'll just get the VFX team to look at that. I don't need to look at that. Well, I just love learning new tools. I just love finding new things. It excites when Midjourney came out, I'm like, what is this thing? This is cool. And that's the thing with Unreal, that I decided to learn Unreal is probably the best decision I made in my career, because in pandemic, I could have just sat there waiting for my agent to call me and say, oh, it's okay now, the TV show is being greenlit. No, I thought, fuck this. I'm just going to like find ways to keep making content, because that's definitely that makes me happy, is making content, you know?
Oh, we really do. We really do. Because that's also what makes us happy. It's a battle. And I think there's it's a steep learning curve. But there is this thing. I don't know what it is. Like, well, I spend a lot of time in a mocap suit. And there's this moment where you look at it, you just go, this is new. And because we don't know what it's going to be, there's a lot of freedom in that, just to go, but no one's going to tell me that it has to be this. I say what it's going to be, and that's my decision. So yeah. And I love that. It's just sort of fresh and new, and I'm sure it'll stop being that in a few years, but at the moment it really is. And that's
ride it while we can.
Exactly.
Luke, you wanted to say something. I feel bad. Luke's trying to say something.
No, I've been very much listening and thoroughly enjoying the episode for most of it. But no, I agree with all of that. That is absolutely true. The only thing I was going to finish on was go and play Moontopia and Colin McRae Rally. If you haven't played it, oh, I'm going to dig out a PlayStation 1 and play it. It's excellent. That's much my final thought. Less hard hitting, but still.
Absolutely. Well, Haz, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. It's been a 10-year mission of mine to get you into a conversation, but I feel like it's our paths have finally converged at the right moment in our lives. And I hope this is not the end of the dialogue anyway.
Definitely. Thank you so much for like making this happen, guys. Like, let's keep collaborating, let's keep supporting each other, and let's just keep like, you know, discovering, like you said.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Luke, is that the pod?
Boom. That's the pod. Yes. That was excellent. Poof. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Poof.